Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. I'm Doug Cunnington, and I'm recording with producer Chris today. Chris, how's it going?
It's going good. How are you doing, Doug?
Awesome. And fun topic today, maybe a little controversy. We're going to talk about financial advisors and why you might want to work with an advisor or maybe not work with an advisor. So Chris, we're not going to go through your whole background here, but you started working with an advisor, and I do too. So we're coming at this potentially biased a little bit, but we were biased before, and we're going to give hopefully a balanced kind of picture. So you'll have a better idea out there if you want to work with an advisor. So just as a little background, just a little of your story as far as like working with an advisor or not working with one.
I was always, like most people in our community, always a DIYer and thought that would continue forever. I could just do this all on my own. I have enough knowledge. And probably a year or so ago, thought, I always hear about financial advisors. Maybe it's worth giving them a try. And so kind of went down that rabbit hole probably over the past year or so, and actually just recently worked with an advisor. So happy to talk about this more today and kind of share my story as we go.
Cool. Yep. And we'll divide this up into why not to work with an advisor and why you might want to work with an advisor. And we'll give you some tips along the way. And I think, you know, you mentioned your own experience, so maybe we could pepper that in along the way. And I'm sure we'll have specific examples for working with the pros and cons and all that kind of stuff. And on our side, echoing you, we were DIYers for about 12 years or so. So we calculated our net worth in 2014. Previously, we were working with advisors, and one of them was an insurance agent that I was working with. But then we took it over in 2014. And then I guess it was 2024. So I guess only 10 years. In 2024, we hired an advisor. And the main thing was some of the things we'll talk about, but the main thing was like giving my wife the confidence to actually like quit her W-2 and be very confident in that decision where she would not need to go back to work. That was one of her big fears. And we had some disagreements around how conservative to be with projections and spending and expenses in a number of different areas, just all related to like conservative versus aggressive investing or spending or projections. So just curious, from the financial management in your household, did you and your wife like work together? Did you mainly take it? Did she have it? And then you worked together just during the DIY period?
Yeah, during that period, it was mostly me. And I was the one in the household who had all the interest in learning about finances and actually digging into the nuts and bolts. Of course, like everyone else, I had my spreadsheet. I was always into reading books, listening to podcasts, talking to others about money. So I was the one who had most of the interest. And I would come at it wanting to educate her. And she was on board. It made sense to her at a high level. But she just never had the interest to actually dive deep into it. And I would keep her updated on what we were doing, kind of what our overall goal was. But she let me run with it. And she's been very supportive this whole time too. But I think also one of the reasons we did want to work with the advisor is just so that she could get another voice. And I wanted to make sure it wasn't just me kind of telling her everything is going to be okay. I wanted her to feel that comfort on her own. So it sounds probably pretty similar to you and Elizabeth.
All right. As a disclaimer, we are not financial professionals, as I think everyone knows. Just entertainment. We're going to tell our own stories. Go find your own professionals to talk to and get advice. Did I cover all the legal stuff, Chris?
I think so. Sounds pretty legal to me.
All right. Yeah. And you're not a lawyer, so I shouldn't even take legal advice from you. But I think that works. You're the producer. I mean,
yeah, we're good.
Okay.
We're good.
Perfect. Let's get into why you don't want to work with an advisor. And I think the FIRE community generally just, I mean, we don't like advisors. We talk bad about them all the time. And many advisors actually listen to the show. So if you're listening, we're not talking about you, but there's definitely some issues with it. Now, in the past, Chris, did you work with an advisor like way back in the day? Like I mentioned, Elizabeth and I had folks we were working with early in our careers, but did you guys at all?
No, never did. Never did. It was always self-education. It was always, I had the interest. I read the books, listened to the podcast, and forever thought, yeah, I could do this on my own. Not too tough. So we never worked with someone until very recently.
All right. So we'll tag team some of these points here. I mentioned that I ended up working with an insurance company that helped, in air quotes, helped with investments. And I'll mention it was Northwestern Mutual. So if one of your friends is like, hey, do you want to meet with my financial guy? He works at Northwestern Mutual. I would suggest that you don't do it. They're going to try to sell you insurance because that's how they get paid. And if their financial tool for you to invest in the future is insurance, then they're going to try to use that hammer for everything they can. Now, I will say, I did work with them. They helped in a couple ways. One, I set up a Roth and I was actually saving in a positive way. I was not investing in the best things. I was not index fund investing. I just followed whatever they told me blindly because I thought, oh, they're professionals. But it didn't occur to me that they were just selling me products that I didn't really need, like a whole life policy, and then adding to the whole life policy in the future because it was a good buy. And I didn't know. I thought, okay, I'm focusing on my career and this guy seems nice. He's buying me coffee. It was like a $40,000 coffee I got. I should have just bought the coffee myself. But anyway, insurance agents are not good folks to work with for investments. They might be able to help you with your insurance, but go to the right person. So do you have any thoughts on the insurance angle?
Yeah. And I think the caveat there is there's probably some types of insurance that can work in some people's situations. So we probably can't just say every insurance is bad, but it has to be a unique situation for every person. But kind of going back to your point, though, about working with that insurance agent, I think the big red flag is whenever someone leads with product, and in your case, it was insurance, and they're trying to shoehorn your situation into what they're trying to sell, I think that's something to watch out for. And I think that's, you know, what a lot of people get caught up in is just, it's the wrong product for the wrong person, and it's the motivation behind it. A lot of these people, whether they're insurance salesmen, whether they are advisors for one of the big brokerages like Merrill Lynch or Edward Jones, they have their own products and their own motivations to try to sell to you. And so I think that's where the issue comes in, the conflict of interest. They're trying to further their own business at the expense of you as a customer.
We're a good counterbalance here. So since this is just entertainment and stories that I'm making up anyway, I'll blanket, and it's okay if we disagree, Chris. So I'll blanket and say, for your investing purposes, insurance is always a bad idea. There may be like one little sliver of people where it's like, oh yeah, insurance is a good idea. But basically, like, get insurance for insurance and then investment things for investment things. But again, this is all just entertainment and it's good to have the counterbalance. Okay, moving on. You want to take the next?
So I think the other thing too is fees. And that's something that we're all aware of in this community. It's just paying for either high fees or unnecessary fees. And in this world of professional financial advice, there's I guess the good fees, which would be like an hourly flat fee. But what we hear a lot about of the horror stories, it's really associated with these bad fees, which are assets under management or even commissions based. If someone sells you a product, like a specific insurance product, a specific mutual fund, a lot of the time the people selling it to you, they get a commission, they get paid for you to buy it. And so that's kind of where that conflict of interest comes in that we were just talking about. And then the other one is the assets under management, where you have so much of your portfolio with a specific advisor. Maybe it's hundreds of thousands of dollars, maybe it's millions of dollars. But regardless of the outcome per year, whatever they have you invested in, you're going to pay them no matter what. And it's usually, I think 1% is standard, maybe 1.5%. So no matter how they perform, they're going to take their money at the end of the year, no matter what.
And just like you had the caveat before, there are certain advisors, like our advisor, Steve, he has a cap for the assets under management. And he has, we don't use him to manage our assets. We just get the advice from him. But if he is managing assets, it's sort of a graduated scale and it's capped. It's something I would say in air quotes reasonable. And I think it's under 1%. I don't remember, people have to look, but there's different packages out there. And you could, potentially you could negotiate if you're like, I'm just doing index funds. So you don't have to do anything, but it's easier if someone else rebalances, for example. So a big thing though, that I didn't realize until we fired our advisors. So right before we fired them, they did make a pitch. They were like, hey, we could be your advisors. We'll be fiduciary advisors. And we only charge, still insurance agents, by the way. We only charge, I think it was one, it could have been 1.5%, which it sounds very small, but if our returns are going to be like 8%, that's like, is that 16%, 17%? It knocks down your returns each year, and obviously compounding over some time totally fucks the whole thing up. And people just don't realize how much 1% is. That said, I'll give another caveat, and then you could disagree with me, Chris. So we'll go back and forth. It's like a debate club or whatever. So most of the time, the assets under management, not a great idea, kills your returns. However, if you know what you're walking into, and let's say you were DIY in the accumulation phase and you've done really well and you're like, I don't want to think about it anymore. I will sign up with this person. They'll rebalance it. And I know what I'm paying and I know the service I'm getting. If you're cool with that, that's totally fine. I know a couple people that do that and they have no issue with it. By the way, you don't have to have your whole portfolio managed by someone. You could just segment off a portion of it. And then it's not whatever, 1% on several million dollars. It's just that little segment. And again, if you know what you're paying for, maybe that's a good trade-off. So,
yeah, I agree. We actually agree in this case. I think jumping ahead too a little bit to why to work with an advisor, it's because like what you said, it's some people need that help and they know they need the help. I think the trade-off is, okay, if they didn't get the help, they would be doing nothing. And you had mentioned when you worked with your insurance agent / advisor, you weren't in the best investments. You probably could have done better on your own, but it did get you to open the Roth. It did get you probably to start thinking about money. So there are benefits to, even if you are paying high fees or in the wrong types of products, it's not totally a loss.
Moving on to the next one, maybe why you don't want to work with an advisor, is if you're in the accumulation phase. And I think this describes us and a lot of the people that you and I know right now that are working with advisors. They were able to move into indexing fairly straightforward. We accumulated money during our careers and then we had great markets. So now we're thinking, it's a little more complicated. So we're working with advisors, but it was pretty straightforward because if you're just using index funds, then you don't have to do anything too complicated. So if you're in the accumulation phase, then maybe you don't really need to work with an advisor because it's pretty straightforward.
Part of probably our bias too in this financial independence community, it's just because most of us are DIYers. And we do have that interest in managing our own money, learning about how to invest, taking care of it ourselves. And so I think we just think that, I think everyone else in the rest of the world feels the same way. They're smart enough to handle their own investments. They can do it on their own. And I think that's what just drives us to have that negative thought about working with an advisor in general.
You want to take the next?
Sure. And I think this is pretty similar too. It's because a lot of us are DIYers and we do have a good deal of knowledge about our own money. One of the things that holds us back, and it did hold me back too, was narcissism or even some shame, thinking that, hey, I'm smart enough to handle my own money. I can listen to podcasts. I can read books. I can talk to people. I can figure this thing out on my own. A sense of, hey, I don't need anybody else. I can do this by myself. So I think it's really just, it's coming to accept that, yeah, for the most part, you probably could. And I think people who are willing to put that time in, they can do it. But there's just so many people out there who are not willing to do that.
Really well said. And I think, I don't know if like the narcissism held me back, because I think at some point I realized, a lot of this is like stuff that I can grasp, but there's some things where I'm like, do I really want to get into the details? And one thing that you mentioned is you got a lot of your info from podcasts and blogs and stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And one of the big flaws is just people like us, you and I, Chris, or is it you and me? I don't even know grammar, let alone like financial advice. And I want to read, this is one of the reviews over on Apple Podcast. I had to look this up really quick. And if you want to leave a review to help negate some of the negative reviews that I have out here on the show, this one is titled, "Do Not Listen!" ! I listened to one episode and these guys were literally giving false advice. They said you could withdraw from an HSA for anything after a, quote, certain age, which is incorrect. They didn't differentiate how an IRA contribution or conversion are treated. And basically they said, it's just, these guys are dangerous. So one issue, even though I am the example in this case, I don't know what we said, but we often give the fucking disclaimer, it's not financial advice. Like we're getting pretty close, but talk to someone else. You can't get advice from a fucking podcast. It's crazy. Anyway, I don't think that person listens to the show anymore. But anyway, the point is we can get a ton of information, but we don't know if it's exactly accurate, because sometimes I think Carl and I were probably talking in some shorthand, or we're idiots and we repeated something that we heard from somewhere else that someone else heard from somewhere else. And that's how the internet is, unfortunately. So it's good to get some outside advice, and we can get a ton of information, a lot of mindset stuff, hopefully from a podcast, but sometimes the tactical stuff is not exactly right. And it's very difficult to get the information across accurately in audio form. Very difficult. I don't know if that landed how I hoped it was going to, but what do you think, Chris? Was that okay?
It made sense to me, but I'm probably wrong.
Yeah. I mean, anybody could record a podcast. That's the thing. All right. Tied together really close, it's the peer pressure of being in the FI community, and we're DIYers. We are very smart, and we think we're smarter than we are often. I mean, everybody thinks they're above average, but it turns out most people are average. The thing is, we like to DIY, and if we could do it ourselves, then we really want to do it ourselves. And we'll get into why you want to hire an advisor, but part of it is the peer pressure in the community. And sometimes, right, like even the examples we gave, if you're in the accumulation phase, maybe you don't need an advisor, but maybe you have a complicated situation and you do need some advice. So like everything is not one size fits all here. So peer pressure in our community, hopefully like people talking about hiring advisors and why they do it and when, opens the door for people that do need some advice to get an outside perspective, for example. So let's move on to why you might want to hire an advisor. And we'll wrap up at the end and give you some specific tips and stuff like that, and maybe places to go and check out, places to hire an advisor if you want to, if it seems like it could be a good fit. So this is a few all under the idea of getting an outside perspective. And the number one reason, they're all related, right? You know, why you don't want to hire an advisor. This blind spot that everyone has, you don't know what it is, right? Because it's a blind spot. So by definition, you don't even know that you have a gap in knowledge. And if you're thinking to yourself, I'm so smart, I read so many books, I don't have a blind spot, that's when you're most susceptible, when you think you know everything. And you don't. You don't know everything. There's something that you're missing, or you could do a little bit better. It may be a trivial thing, but everybody has a blind spot. And when you start thinking, I can't learn anymore, that's when you really need to look out. So it's kind of it's a weird thing. And I've been there before. So I always try to remember, you don't know everything, and there's always something to learn, and whatever my approach might be could be completely wrong. So I really want to try to get different perspectives in there. So the summary is, like, we all have blind spots. You don't know what it is. Sometimes a pair of fresh eyes, a professional in the financial industry, can look and see, like, oh, did you know that you should consider more Roth conversions in these years versus other years, right? Maybe you don't think of that. You just think, hey, conversions are up. But this, I'll give a specific example. This is one of those times where a specific example that we ran across. So we were planning on doing Roth conversions, but it turns out the ACA, the healthcare marketplace, has some specific income ranges where you can get a subsidy versus not getting a subsidy. And it turns out it could be like many thousands of dollars. So is it better to do Roth conversions or take the subsidy? That's a tough one to figure out, because you're thinking about long-term tax benefits over the course of many years versus money right now. And we don't know, like, what the impact is going to be over time. Just changing your expected returns each year really skews it. So that's one area where it's like, kind of have a blind spot. No one really knows the right answer, but having someone to go through and just have a dialogue about it really helps. Just curious, did you guys run into anything like that too?
Pretty much the exact same situation. It was trying to balance Roth conversions versus taking the premium tax credit with the ACA. So that's one of the big things that did drive us to working with the advisor, seeing that as a blind spot, but also just needing help. And it kind of rolls into our next reason why to work with an advisor too. It's just someone else to talk to. Even though I might think that we know all this, maybe at a high level, we know, okay, I want to take Roth conversions versus taking the premium tax credit. I want to do this or that. It's just having that second set of eyes, that objective third party to go through and say, nope, Doug, you thought about this the wrong way. Or you were listening to too many podcasts. They gave you the wrong advice. Here's the right way to think about it. So it's just someone to bounce ideas off of. And I think part of that is hard too. We had mentioned earlier, for me, the narcissism part, oh yeah, I know all the stuff. I don't need help. But I think the hard part is kind of being humble enough to know that maybe I do know a lot, but I also don't know a lot, and just kind of giving in to, okay, yeah, it's no harm in working with someone else and letting them just pick through this, make sure I didn't miss anything, especially obvious.
Digging deep into this outside perspective, I mentioned at the opening that Elizabeth wanted to make sure that we didn't make a silly mistake in our own projections and the due diligence of a professional external third party was essential for her to be able to actually retire. She wouldn't have trusted her own analysis or mine. It's just like, looks pretty good between the two of us. having someone else come in and make sure that she wouldn't have to go back to work because we made some silly mistake, which I don't think we were going to make a silly mistake, but it gave her the confidence. And for some people, they need that external validation.
It is good when you're dealing with something big like a retirement or a big sum of money. It's always good to get that second set of eyes just on there and giving this unbiased opinion.
Last one in this area. So a financial advisor, I mean, one of their main goals is to make sure that you're not going to run out of money. When we're going at the stage that you and I went, we're already retired. We went a long-term plan. So their perspective is like probably de-risking a little bit. But one of the issues with podcasters, I think we'd really be mean to podcasters because we're podcasting right now, but bloggers, podcasters, YouTubers, any sort of influencer, they may have like a completely different perspective, especially like if you are following some of the early FIRE content folks, they were trying to retire very early. And maybe, I mean, I remember listening to, I think Carl maybe even mentioned it sometimes. So it's like people just want the best returns. They're like, I'm going to go completely into just S&P 500, 100%. I don't want any bonds. I don't want anything else. No international, just that. And it could be, and I'm not telling you what's right or wrong or whatever, but some people are just like, I only want the biggest returns and I don't give a shit about anything else. Maybe that works great for them. Maybe they changed their mind since they put out that content. Or maybe someone is like, I want to minimize all taxes no matter what. I don't give a shit what I have to do. I don't want to pay taxes. And they're doing all their optimization around that. So from that perspective, like it's completely different than a financial advisor who's like, we're creating a 50-year plan and we're going to make sure you don't run out of money and you'll be able to spend how you want and we'll build this whole analysis together. So completely different perspective. And when we're in our little vacuum chamber of FIRE content creators, it could be a little bit, well, echo chambery. So any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think I agree with you, Doug. I think we're just stuck in this echo chamber where maybe different podcasters, different bloggers, they have different motives than others of us. And I think we each have our own unique financial situation. So that kind of plays into it too. It's we have to make sure we're doing what's best for ourselves and our situation and not just taking blanket statements and trying to wedge them into our own lives.
Right. Next one is around working with an advisor and why, even if you're accumulating, it might be okay if you have sort of a complicated situation. In chatting with people, I have heard it's usually folks with like a lot of different investment options where they think maybe like the military or teachers, they're sometimes able to invest in several different similar accounts, especially the pre-tax accounts. And I personally am not in that world, so I don't even know, but I have heard of folks where they're like, I'm not sure where to put the money first and I have flexibility. I can make this simple or complicated and they just need a little help. Probably just setting it up. Like that's one of those things. Once you have a plan, execute the plan, do it for a few years, maybe a couple decades, whatever makes sense for you. And then, you know, hopefully retire. But the point is, once you have it set up, you don't have to necessarily get help all the time. Maybe it's like every couple years or every 5 years or something like that. Do you happen to know anyone that is in those two areas?
Actually, I do. You sounded like you described one of my good friends. He has a lot of different options, him and his wife, through their workplaces. It's 457s, maybe these, I think they're government-run pension options. And he always has a question of, what should I be in? Always hearing, it's part of our community too, hey, you should be maybe going towards a taxable account. You should be going towards pre-tax and all these different competing priorities. And he's just confused as far as what's the optimal way to deploy this money. And so I think in this situation, having the advisor to kind of go through and walk through, okay, here's the benefit of option A, here's the benefit of option B. And while it's never going to, we're never going to be able to predict what the outcome is going to be until after the fact, it's just knowing that here are your options in a clear way, and it's up to my friend to make his choice on how he wants to go about it. And I think it's similar for us in the decumulation phase, probably even a little bit trickier. There's just so many ways to get this done. And I think probably you and I and many others in this community, we just want to do it optimally. Kind of going back to that, having the other person to talk to and walk through our options and figure out what can we do. That is really a big benefit of all this.
The next couple that we have are kind of a pair that go together. So you mentioned decumulation. We talked about if you're accumulating, maybe you don't need an advisor, but decumulation can be a little bit more tricky. It doesn't have to be. And like for us, we actually had a nice portfolio where there was some in a 401k and similar type accounts. And then we have a Roth. And then we also have a post-tax brokerage account. So it gives us full flexibility. We actually have a lot of money that's accessible in that post-tax brokerage account. So ours wasn't too complicated, and we could not reinvest dividends and then get the dividends and put those into our cash flow spending accounts or whatever, or we could sell a little bit, but ours was fairly straightforward. Some folks have almost all their money in the pre-tax retirement accounts. You can access those sometimes. I got to make sure that mean reviewer doesn't come back and say I said false things. So there are some things like I think a 72T, and there are just different strategies. You could take a penalty too. Sometimes, I mean, if you have like great returns, like I don't want to go back and do the math, but there's probably a decent argument that if I just put everything into my traditional IRA or a 401k, the returns would have outweighed any of the penalties that I maybe would have had to pay. I don't want to calculate that because we've had a good 15 years or so here. But anyway, the decumulation may be a little more complicated for folks. And again, accumulating is more straightforward, and we've done that for years, so we're kind of comfortable with it. But decumulating is a little more tricky. And the related thing is around the confidence to spend more. And many of us are frugal. We don't want to just be too extravagant. Not that you need to be, but you may have oversaved. A lot of us did oversave, and you're able to spend a little bit more, but we're so conservative that we don't really have the confidence to do it. So those coupled together, the decumulation and the confidence to spend, they can work together. Now, did you guys have any reservations on decumulation, or were you pretty confident in your strategy?
I think for us, we had a hesitation. I think this whole time going into it, it's roughly, we'll use the 4% rule. And, you know, based on that, we had enough to kind of get us through retirement. But it was always those details of, okay, what is our specific strategy? What are the nuts and bolts? And I had known at a high level, okay, here's what I wanted to do. You know, maybe do Roth conversions versus taking part of our taxable account versus how do we capture the optimal ACA subsidies. So it was just all these competing things that at a high level, I knew what I wanted to do, but at the nuts and bolts of it, it's like, how do we actually go about doing this? And so that's kind of where, what drove us really to work with our planner on how do we go about doing this in a good way, not just kind of winging it. Let's actually talk through what our options are. So that's kind of what our situation was there.
And I'll ask some questions that maybe will lead into some of the other points here. So are you working with your advisor on a long-term basis, or is it annual, or how is it set up? What's the commitment?
So we're doing an hourly. So we're paying by the hour. And we started, this was actually just a couple months ago, back in October. And it was just a comprehensive review, putting all our information out there. Here's what our current financial picture looks like. Here's what our goals are. Here's what we want to be doing with our lives. And it was just getting that initial plan, the look of, okay, based on what we stated, here's how on track are we to reach those goals. And here's maybe any tweaks that we should make. And our plan going forward now is we do have a written plan. So because I am the DIYer, I can take that plan and execute it myself. If I need to, I can sell my own shares of Vanguard. I can move money around. I'm competent enough that way. And our goal is to, I think, once a year, go back to our planner and just, we'll do a review. Okay, here's how the past year has been, probably the end of 2026. Okay, how do the markets react? Are we still on track for these goals? Do we have any big life changes, life events that we want to, I guess, handle or take advantage of? And so it's going to be kind of an ongoing thing. And so right now, we're just going to take it kind of one step at a time.
How many hours did it take to pull together the plan that you described?
I think a lot of it was on our own. It was really me kind of going through all of our accounts. I had done that before, but it was really digging deep. It was, you know, obviously our financial statements, going through Vanguard, going through our bank account, pulling that up. But it actually was more comprehensive too. We did pull up our beneficiary details. We did pull up our estate planning. So it was really a comprehensive look at our whole financial life, which I thought was really good. And this kind of goes contrary to you had mentioned before, your insurance salesman who probably didn't do that. It was probably more, don't want to speak for you, but it's probably more of, you know, hey, here's what you and Elizabeth should be in. And that's it. So I think this is more of a comprehensive view. And to answer your question, it probably took maybe 10 hours for myself to gather all this information. We passed it on to our planner and we had a couple conversations, I think a couple 1 hour sessions to really talk through. At first, he had questions on, hey, what did you mean by this? Can you expand more on this type of account? Can you talk more about your goals? And then about a week later, he turned it around and was able to say, okay, here's your plan. Let's talk through it. Do you have any questions? Overall, I want to say probably like 15 hours.
Okay.
And so it was relatively painless.
And then it sounds like you paid him maybe for like 3 to 5 hours or something. And how much per hour?
It was 300 per hour.
Okay.
I think that's the going rate. I've heard that's other planners charging 300 to 400. So it was in the ballpark. And I guess that was a tough part for me too. Something that I need to get over. It's yes, we are paying for advice. It seems like a lot of money on the surface, but to get this once a year review, I think it was well worth it.
Perfect. All right. So people are not going to like this one. So everybody just take a breath. Your friends in the FI space are not pros. So you described it well, Chris. You have to pay a pro a few hundred dollars an hour. And it's not cheap. You could do other, you could take a little vacation for $1,500 or whatever, right? So it's not nothing. It's actually a decent amount of money. And while we have really smart friends in the FI community, I don't want to go to my friend and be like, hey, can you review all this stuff? I'm really counting on you. Like, it's a lot of pressure. And hell, I mean, some of the people are even advisors, but that's even worse. I wouldn't want to go to an advisor and say, hey, can you fucking help me for free? Like, that's not cool. That's not cool at all. So there's something about working with a professional that has a certification and you're paying them good money and they have a professional responsibility to help you out. And there's something different taking your spreadsheet and going to a friend. Again, we know a lot of people in the community. We could probably get some great advice, but I think there's a time for that probably. And there's a time to go to a professional and get professional help. And hopefully that didn't ruffle too many feathers, but I'll stick by that. Like when you need a pro, like go to a pro and pay them good money, whatever they're worth, do it. It can be worth it. I'm not saying everybody needs to, but there's definitely a time and a place for it.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Doug. It's kind of like getting medical advice. You know, if you have an issue, maybe you talk to your friends, to some family who has, you know, gone through something similar, and you could look it up on the internet. But when it comes down to it, it's important enough, whether it be health or your money, it's worth paying for that professional advice to make sure you get good quality advice and not just someone's probably or potentially incorrect opinions.
All right. We got to start wrapping up here. This is one coming up that I didn't necessarily think about, but in talking to a couple friends on why they hired advisors, some of these folks have been retired for a decade. They wanted a trusted party to be able to work with their surviving family members if something happened to them. So obviously, we're all going to die. Sorry to be the one to tell you, we're all going to die. Hopefully it'll be very long from now. But in the case that, you know, you're leaving some of your family members behind, they will be stressed out. They'll be grieving. To have a trusted party that could help out and knows the moving pieces. Maybe you've already worked, the survivors have already met or talked to them. They kind of know what's going on. Really can help out and relieve some of the stress, especially if it's a very untimely, unexpected death. And, you know, it's something we don't want to think about, but it's something, if you're making a long-term plan, is something you should think about. And it's great to have that party in your network already.
I totally agree. In my situation, my wife, at a high level, she knows what's going on. She kind of knows what our strategy is. But I do worry about the day, most likely, I'll be the one to pass first. It's what's going to happen to her. Who can she work with? She's not going to want to go through and manage everything like I did. And so part of it is keeping it simple. You know, how can we create a plan that would be easy for her to follow? But I think most importantly, like you said, Doug, it's who can she turn to when she's going to need help? It's really not an if, but it's probably a when. So it's, can we build that relationship now with someone, whether it's our current planner or whether it's someone else we find along the way? It's just when the time comes, who's going to help take care of her financially?
Side one that we didn't even mention here, you can work with an advisor like hourly, like you mentioned, but you could also work with someone for a year or two, get things going. It's not like you're marrying them, right? Like you can stop working with them. Maybe you want to take a different direction. Maybe you didn't work together well and you don't like their personality, or they don't like you, or whatever, and you can go somewhere else. So it's not like you're signing up forever in perpetuity. You could work with someone for as long or short as you want to.
I think the biggest thing for me too, besides decumulation and all the numerical, mathematical nuances of that part of it, for me, it really was help with mindset. Not only having someone to talk to just about different issues and bounce ideas off of, but I'm one of those people. I am in early retirement and I still do struggle with withdrawing money, spending money. And that may seem weird to a lot of people, but it's just over all these years of accumulating, taking money, save for 20 years, it's hard to flip that switch. And that's something I've personally struggled with the past few years. It's how do I do that? And so for the mindset piece, it's just getting that comfort level of, okay, yeah, someone is looking at my plan. They're giving their thumbs up of, yeah, this looks good. And talking me through, kind of walking me back from the ledge, like, yeah, you're going to be good. Something less to worry about. I think there's a lot of people out there, whether it be with spending or anything else, just that mindset piece of it. What maybe it's a, we're in a downturn, the market's down, and intellectually we know that don't do anything. Market will most likely come back up, whether it's a few months or years or whatever. But I think that psychological piece, just having that someone to talk to and reassurance to just hold steady. And I think that's a big benefit of having an advisor to talk to.
A lot of people are right there with you. I think probably most of the FI and FIRE community, we have that sort of frugal mindset, and it's harder for us to spend more. And it, you know, like any change, like gradually is a little bit easier. And if you have someone supporting you with a mindset shift and saying, hey, you can spend a little bit more, it's totally okay. Maybe you don't listen the first time around, but maybe the next meeting or the next quarter or whatever, you're like, okay, like we can book this trip or finish the basement or whatever kind of thing that you're working on. We got to start wrapping up here, but I do want to mention that if you are looking for hourly help or even a full package, Nectarine is a company that we're an affiliate for in Mile High FI. And we've actually interviewed the founder, Jeremy Schneider, a couple times. Good guy, hung out with him in person, but we're an affiliate. So if you do work with them, you end up supporting the show indirectly through a commission. It's something small. I think it's like 10%. Can't remember. I don't know. I just have to put the disclaimer out there. But if you're interested in the hourly, fee-only, advice-only situation, you can go there. I do know they have a package deal where you can get like the full retirement package. I think like kind of what you're describing, Chris, like what you got. And that kind of alleviates some of the long-term commitment, or maybe a lot of people email and they have like one little question and you could probably get it answered in a couple hours, I'm assuming. So check out Nectarine if you're interested in getting that hourly advice. Now, Chris, you wrote the last one here. I want you to mention this one here.
Oh, yeah. So I think the biggest reason to work with an advisor is just the realization that people do need help. And I think we are in our FI bubble here where a lot of us, most of us are DIYers, and we love talking about money. We handle our own finances and no big deal. But looking at other people in my life, my parents, some friends, neighbors, almost everyone else, I think most people do need help. And I think it's whether due to lack of knowledge or just due to lack of interest, people do need to get help. Otherwise, like you had mentioned earlier, Doug, you might have not done anything at all. And I can see this in other people's lives as well. So it's just a good way to take that first step forward and just move in the right direction. It might not be the optimal path, but at least you're taking that first step forward, and there's always ways to correct later down the road.
Well said. And I think we could go back and do the full wrap up, but we'd just be repeating ourselves. So, Chris, thank you for joining me today. Where can people find your blog?
I am over at Epic Financial Journey, a blog with one of my friends. We talk about just personal finance, financial independence, and family. So if you're interested, come check it out over there.
All right. Thanks a lot. And I'll talk to you soon, man.
Sounds good. Thanks, Doug.
Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High FI podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do three things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. Chris, you were telling me that you use a Ninja 11-in-1 cooker. And I love cooking. I love gear and gadgets and all that stuff. Number one, what are you cooking today in that 11-in-1? And then the second question is, what are the 11 things? So I hope you could list them all. Yeah, what are you cooking today?
Okay, so the easy answer, what am I cooking? I'm going for pulled pork. This is really my first run with this cooker. I just bought this for Black Friday and thought I'd give it a whirl. And I usually use a smoker outdoors, but living in Seattle, can never count on the weather. So I thought I'd switch to an indoor appliance. And I usually use a crock pot, but saw this Black Friday deal, thought I'd try it out and go with an old standard, pulled pork.
Nice. Can you name at least a couple of the things? I know you probably can't do all 11, but if you can, that'll be amazing. It's like a commercial for this product.
Okay, let me give it a try. We got crock pot, sous vide, there's a bake feature, and 8 more.
I bet pressure cooker is usually in one of those, right?
Pressure cooker, there's actually a rice, and there's a pasta feature.
Okay, so some of it is just like the method, or not necessarily the method, but it's like the specific thing that you're cooking.
That's what kind of drew me into it. I always see these all-in-one cookers. We had an Instant Pot, but of course, being frugal, we got the knockoff version, but still pretty good. So we thought we'd give this other all-in-one a try.
Cool. Got it. So I do love a crock pot. Use it all the time. One of the... I never had an Instapot. And part of it is... I'm not really in that big of a hurry to cook. So I know there's some advantages or whatever, but I'm like, you know what? I'm doing slow stuff. One great advantage of that is usually instead of like a small window of like when something's done, if you're going crockpot style, or in this case, I mean, the Ninja 11-in-1 cooker, this is not sponsored by the way. Unless Chris, did they hire you? to infiltrate and put this in, but I'm just kidding. Anyway, you have a huge amount of leeway if you're cooking for like 8 hours. There's like a 3-hour window where it's like, it's probably fine and you don't have to rush around or whatever. So very interesting. So with the knockoff Instapot, did it eventually break or something like that? Was that the issue or?
No, surprisingly, it's still going. I think it was from Best Buy. Whatever the Best Buy brand was. And this was probably 4 or 5 years ago when it was Instapot was the big craze. We thought, yeah, let's give it a try. But, you know, being frugal, I don't want to jump into something that I may not ever commit to.
Yeah. Understand. One thing. Yeah. So I usually don't get too many appliances. Many things take up so much room. And I mentioned I like crock pots. I think we have like 4 of them. They're not all the same size, but like at some point it's just like, okay, this is all taking up a whole lot of space. And am I really using all this stuff? So that's one reason why I try not to like buy a bread machine and then like too many little things. Now, do you guys have an air fryer? People seem to love those as well.
No, that's actually one of the things that was on my list to try out. You know, still jury's out on that one. Would I ever use it? That's the big thing for me.
And that's another one where, so our oven technically has an air fryer setting on there and it's like a souped up convection situation. So it does a decent job, but per my understanding, an actual air fryer really moves the air. And it's like, I don't know whatever the throughput of the air that is blasting through there. But I guess it does cook it a little faster than the oven. But it's one of those where I'm like, I know it's not doing exactly the same thing in our oven, but we're getting by. Now, crazy thing, our microwave actually has another air fryer setting, and it actually, yeah, it's like a little oven. So there's a heating element and you could put metal in there because you could like turn, it sounds crazy, right? You could turn off the microwave waves and just have like the convection inside the microwave. So it's kind of weird, but mm-hmm. if you don't have the setting right, you put in a cookie sheet and it's like, you know, going. I haven't made that mistake luckily, but anyway, kind of crazy, but yeah, so many gadgets. Any other go-to gadgets in the kitchen where you're like, this is something I really love to have?
Can opener or electric can opener. Just never got around to buying one.
Gotcha. You just have an old school like hand crank one. It's funny. As an adult, I think I've only had the hand crank, but growing up we had, yeah, an electric can opener thing. Interesting. Yeah, that's something you could make happen. I bet you could go buy one today.
We'll see.